As you'll know, tears are a very powerful thing. As my family continues to grow, tears are becoming an ever-frequent thing in my house. Whether it's my tears or any of the three girls' tears, there just seem to be tears everywhere all the time. Didn't get what you want? Tears. Hit your head on that same old table? Tears. Wrong Bluey episode? Tears. Tired? Tears. No milk in my morning coffee? Tears. Frustrated? Tears. Hungry? Tears. You see, tears are everywhere. Tears are a powerful thing, aren't they? They're powerful because tears speak. Tears tell us stuff. They can say, I'm hurt, I'm sad, I'm joyful, I'm angry, I'm relieved, I'm dissatisfied. You see, more often than not, tears are a reliable voice to the things deep inside. Tears tell us something. And so when we see tears, when we see someone crying, we naturally ask, don't we? Why are you crying? What's wrong? Why are you upset? You see, tears speak. And over the coming days, we're going to be hearing Luke's account of the Easter story. And this morning, we're going to be looking at Jesus' entry into Jerusalem. And here in Luke 19, we'll see the king come with tears. And as spectators to this significant moment, Luke wants us to ask the question, Jesus, why are you crying? Jesus, why are you crying? And what we're going to discover is that Jesus' tears speak. They actually tell us something. This morning, Jesus' tears have something to say to you, to each one of us. Whether you've been a follower of Jesus for a long time, or whether you're a new follower of Jesus, or whether you're not yet a follower of Jesus, his tears have something to say to each one of us. And so what we're going to do is we're going to hear the story, and then we're going to bring it all together at the end. Here's the story. For some time now in Luke's account, Jesus has resolutely set out for Jerusalem. He has turned his face toward the city and he's been journeying toward it. And along the way, Jesus has been telling his followers that this must happen. It's necessary for Jesus to enter Jerusalem and then to suffer many things. And in verses 28 to 40 of our passage, Luke brings a whole heap of small details together to show us that this Jesus is divine royalty. What he does is he emphasizes the route, the transport, the search, the cloaks, the praise, and even the opposition to cast Jesus as the royal one who will deliver his people from their enemies. He's the one who's going to bring peace. And Luke, you'll notice that he begins with the route. In verses 28 and 29, we find that the Lord Jesus begins his journey to Jerusalem via the Mount of Olives. Now, this is important. Just as we might pay attention to the travel itinerary of the royal family, Luke wants us to pay attention to Jesus' travel itinerary. And on two occasions in this passage, Luke directs our attention to the fact that Jesus travels near the Mount of Olives. The first one's in verse 29, and then the second in verse 37. And this is significant because in the book of Zechariah, in the Old Testament, it was predicted that the Lord would rescue Israel from her enemies and he would come to Jerusalem via the Mount of Olives. It's in Zechariah 14. You see, the route which Jesus takes suggests that he's coming to Jerusalem as the promised king. He's divine royalty. But then Luke doesn't just want us to notice the travel itinerary. He also wants us to notice Jesus' method of travel. And then in verses 29 and 30, Jesus prepares his transport for Jerusalem. And it's similar to the royal family. Just as the royal family might consider their mode of transport, Luke depicts Jesus doing the exact same thing. But instead of picking the kind of most powerful mode of transport, he picks the humble approach. Instead of requesting to ride a horse, which is associated with wealth and power and war and victory, Jesus opts for a colt. He sends his two disciples to retrieve a humble colt, the foal of a donkey, which belonged to someone else, you'll notice. You see, get the picture. It's as if the royals were rocking up to a significant event in a Toyota Corolla instead of a Ferrari. That's what's going on. And on top of that, they don't even own the Corolla. They have to go and borrow it from someone else. You see, it's a fascinating request. But behind this choice for a colt is another echo back to Zechariah. Zechariah 9, a prophecy about Israel's king coming humbly to Jerusalem on a colt to bring victory over its enemies. You see, even the transportation method suggests that the Lord Jesus is coming as divine royalty. So now, so far, Luke highlights the route, the transportation method, and then now he gives even more attention to the search for this transportation method. Notice in verses 30 to 35, Jesus foretells every detail of the two disciples' search for this colt. He basically says that they'll go to the village ahead, they'll find the colt, they'll untie the colt, and they'll be questioned because it kind of looks like they're stealing at this point. But understandably, somehow, they'll be believed as soon as they simply say, "The Lord needs it." Kind of feels like a prank, doesn't it? It's kind of a prank I would send my brother on. You see, I'd kind of say to him, "Hey, go down to Blackwood Street and you'll find a Corolla. And when you're there, open it, jump inside it. And if anyone at Hobby Lane tells you that's not your Corolla or says you shouldn't take it, just say, Sam needs it." You see, it's ridiculous, isn't it? It's a prank. It feels like one giant prank. But Jesus isn't telling a prank, is he? He isn't sending them on a ridiculous journey. And so what is he doing? Why is Luke highlighting all this detail? Well, again, it's here to remind us that the Lord Jesus is divine royalty. He has real power. He's the king. You see, whilst Jesus will enter Jerusalem on a humble colt, this doesn't suggest, it doesn't suggest that he has no power. No, 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 the Lord Jesus is extremely powerful. And in this story, Jesus refers to himself, notice, as the Lord. He's the God of Israel. He has power, verse 31 and verse 34. Jesus also has the power to predict circumstances, the circumstances of others, such that in verse 32, the disciples found the colt just as Jesus had told them. Jesus is even then depicted as one who can lord it over another lord and take what belongs to him and use it for his purposes. You see, he has power and authority, and Jesus might even be hinting at the kind of effect that his rule and authority has. He'll be the kind of king who unties things, sets things loose, retrieves things, brings them to himself. You see, the search and all these little details, they suggest that the Lord Jesus is coming to Jerusalem as its promised king, as divine royalty. Then, it goes on, after the disciples bring this colt to Jesus and sit him on it, Jesus finally begins his approach. And in verse 36, Jesus rides toward Jerusalem and he receives a royal welcome. Again, picturing the royal family, just as we might roll out the red carpet for them, the crowds of disciples do a similar thing. You can imagine it. Jesus, he rides along and his disciples, they tear off their outer garments and they throw them on the ground. And the colt, foot by foot, steps on each garment. You see, this is an act reserved for kings. It's a royal welcome. And we know that because in 2 Kings 9, King Jehu, king of Israel, he's anointed with oil and then he's declared to be the king. And when those around him acknowledge his position, they take off their outer garments and they put them on the ground for Jehu to walk on. You see, this has happened before. The spreading of cloaks suggests that, like King Jehu, the Lord Jesus is king, divine royalty. But it's not just the disciples' cloaks which point to Jesus' royalty, it's also the praise, isn't it? The sound which comes from their mouths. That's the most clearest picture here, isn't it? In verses 37 and 38, the crowds of disciples erupt in praise to God, because they've seen Jesus' power. They've seen his ability to do miracles. And just as any royal approach is met with praise and honor and glory and fans for their power, it's the same here. The disciples proclaim, "Blessed is the King who comes in the name of the Lord. Peace in heaven and glory in the highest." You see, get the picture. This is a royal rumble for Jesus. It's a royal rumble. And using parts of Psalm 118, a song which is reserved for the enthronement of kings, the disciples use it for Jesus. They declare his royalty. The disciples are rumbling using Psalm 118, saying, "He's the King, he's the King, he's the King, he's the King." And even in the midst of this royal rumble, we hear others speak, don't we? We hear these mood killers come into the scene to try and shut down the party. In verses 39 and 40, Jerusalem's religious leaders, called Pharisees, they command Jesus to rebuke and to disapprove of his followers' actions. You see, the Pharisees, they're somewhat like any parent who yells out at their teenager, "Turn that music down! Mood killers!" That's what they're doing. Jesus comes as king, and the Pharisees are mood killers. Jerusalem's religious leaders effectively demand Jesus to be silenced, to be cancelled, because in their eyes, this royal rumble isn't reserved for him. In their eyes, Jesus isn't a king. In their eyes, these are blasphemous claims if given to Jesus. This is the beginning of the Jerusalem resistance, which we're going to see more and more in the coming days. They're mood killers. But despite this attempt to kill their mood, Jesus says that this attempt is pointless. If the crowds of disciples don't give a royal rumble, he says, well, then the earth's rocks will. You see, Jesus is effectively saying, they're right. I'm divine royalty. I'm Israel's king. You can't shut them up. You can't cancel them. Bring it on. Jerusalem's resistance to Jesus is another indication that the Lord Jesus has come as king. You see, in this scene, the Lord Jesus is depicted as divine royalty who'll bring peace. Luke emphasizes all these small details. He puts them together. The route, the transport, the search, the cloaks, the praise, and even the opposition. But the question remains, what will Jesus do when he enters Jerusalem? What will he do? What will Jesus do when he is faced with his opposition? Will Jesus bring violence against these oppressors? Will Jesus kill those who don't want him as their king? Will Jesus bring destruction upon Jerusalem for this small amount of resistance? What will he do? Well, we know he doesn't do any of that, does he? In verses 41 to 44, Luke depicts Jesus not as the king who wages war, but as the king who weeps. We see divine tears. In verse 41, the Lord Jesus enters Jerusalem, and just imagine it for a moment. He sees the city, and as the noise from the crowd echoes with this muddled praise and rebuke, "Blessed is the King, blessed is the King, Jesus, silence them, silence them." All this goes on and on as he gets closer and closer and closer. And as he sees the city, he bursts into tears. The Lord Jesus weeps. He weeps. What sort of king is this? The one who has every right to yell and to rebuke and to wage war, he weeps in plain sight for everyone to see. And so we ask, Jesus, why are you weeping? And in verse 42 and 44, Luke tells us, Jesus says, "I weep because they do not recognize what makes for peace. I weep because the days will come when this city is turned to rubble. I weep because they do not recognize the day of God's coming." Jesus lets emotions pour out as tears because he is saddened and grieved, and he's aching. He's aching over his people's hard hearts. Jesus weeps because of Jerusalem's unwillingness to recognize who he is and what brings peace. Jesus weeps because his people think that it's necessary for the Christ to wage war instead of suffering, instead of dying, instead of rising. Jesus weeps because of their spiritual blindness, which will result in the siege and destruction of Jerusalem some 70 years later. You see, divine royalty weeps over people's hard hearts. And in the coming days, we'll see this in Luke's account. A people who won't recognize that Jesus is their Lord and their God, a people who won't recognize that the path of peace comes through a cross, not through power, not through miracles, but a cross. You see, tears flow from Jesus' eyes because his people's eyes don't recognize him. He weeps for those who'll soon shout, "Crucify him." And so this morning, Jesus' tears, they're speaking. And I wonder what they're saying to you, to us. I wonder what they're saying. In 2015, Maurice Mickers, he started on a quest to turn tears into works of art. Mickers captures the beauty of tears by crystallizing and subsequently photographing them under a microscope. The results are stunning works of art that have been featured all across the world, National Geographic, Business Insider, and many more places. But what I found most interesting reading about his story is that Mickers started this project because he believed that every tear has a hidden story. He believed that tears say something. And as we consider Christ's tears this morning, I wonder what they're saying to you. You see, in some sense, I think that Jesus' tears, they speak of the entire human tragedy, don't they? His tears speak not only of Jerusalem's inability, but even ours. His tears speak of our hard hearts, our unbelief, our rejection. His tears speak of our efforts to find peace alternatives, of how we chase peace substitutes, often through power, of how we attempt to calm our raging hearts with sex or relationships or money or lifestyle or alcohol or power itself. You see, his tears speak of our unwillingness at times to declare Jesus as Lord and God. See, Jesus' tears speak of our sin. They speak of our tragedy. In another sense, Jesus' tears also speak of the right response. The right response to evil. You see, a Christ-like response to sin, to unbelief, to evil. It begins with grief. It begins with lament. It begins with the shedding of tears. Our evil. Our city's evil. Mitchelton's evil. Should be met with tears. The unbelief that we see in other people our friends or our family members should be met with tears. And when we're saddened by sin, and when we're saddened by unbelief and what we see in others, this is utterly Christ-like. This is utterly Christ-like. When we shed tears over sin, we shed tears with Christ. You see, Jesus' tears speak of the right response to evil. And then Jesus' tears, finally, they speak of something truly stunning. They speak of Christ's heart. Not only do Jesus' tears speak of our tragedy and the Christ-like response to our tragedy, they also speak of his tender heart. It's a window into who he is. His tears speak of his sorrow and his grief and his immense compassion, not for himself, but for others. His tears speak of his immense love, which will soon lead him to a cross. You see, Christ's tears, brothers and sisters, they say something of his heart for us and the depths of that heart. And that should just stun us. This morning, some of you, some of us, we might be doubting these tears. We might be thinking, I don't need these tears. These tears are misguided. I have no such inability. Such pity is unnecessary. And if that's you, can I say, look to Jesus' tears. They're true. They were necessary. Or this morning, there might be some of us who are getting a bit numb to sin and to the evil in life. We might be getting a bit complacent, a bit comfortable, a bit unmoved by sin and its effects. And if that's you, can I say, look to Jesus' tears. Weep with him. Or this morning, there might be some of us who are skeptical of these tears. We might be thinking, would he really weep for me? Would he really care so much, even today? Is this really his heart? And if that's you, look to Jesus' tears. You see, he wept for us. Divine royalty came to Jerusalem with tears. The king didn't wage war, he wept. And his tears speak, they tell us something of our condition, something of the right response to sin, something of his heart for us. His tears should bring us to tears. His tears should stun us. His tears should comfort us. His tears begin to tell us something of the necessity of Easter. This week, I came across these words from an old hymn which sum up a lot of what we've heard this morning. And we'll finish with this. Did Christ weep over sinners? And shall our cheeks be dry? Let floods of repentant grief burst forth from every eye. The Son of God in tears, the wondering angels see. Be astonished, O my soul. He shed those tears for thee.